Yeah, baby.
So what do we got here? It's Thursday. This is the podcast from Paris, The Truth About Markets. Max and Stacy. My name is Stacy. I'm here with Max.
No.
No?
You're Max. I'm Stacy.
You know, we were watching that strange show called Time Trumpet. And they had that strange scene where David Beckham had sewn a vagina into his arm.
Uh-huh.
Did you see that?
Yes, I saw it.
And it was, you know, kind of, a, you know, David Beckham is getting the tattoos and the earrings and the hairdos and the high fashion. And they're saying, well, the natural extension of this would, being a good metro male, would be to have a vagina sewn into your arm. And then at the end of the little clip there, he shows his vagina on his arm, which was actually, I think, a cut-and-paste image of a vagina.
Looks like it.
It didn't look like makeup. It looked like just a cut-and-paste image.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are you allowed to show a vagina in this state on TV like this?
Not in America, but in Britain, yeah.
Even pre-watershed?
Maybe not. Maybe it had to be after 9. But, but you know, I don't know. You know, in Britain, it's amazing what they... There aren't very many restrictions against showing things compared to what you're allowed to say. So you can't say the F word or C word pre-watershed, but you can show body parts.
Right. Well, they're always naked there in Britain. They're always running around naked.
I know.
That's their form, preferred form of protest is let's all get naked and run around naked.
Yeah. Why?
I don't know. It's a cultural thing. In France, they like to get out in the street and they like to go on strike. Mm-hmm. They like to shut down the transportation sector. They like to go out there with big placards and yell at Chirac. Chirac! Chirac! He's a dick! And UK, they like to get naked. In the U.S., whenever they feel upset about something, they gorge themselves on processed food. That's their form of protestation.
Interesting, isn't it?
So this show is dedicated to Mark Thomas.
Oh, yeah?
Mark Thomas! Who's Mark Thomas? Well, he's a very famous man in the U.K., he makes TV shows and does, we saw his live show last year.
He's a political comedian, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, he's pretty up to speed on the politics, you know? He's not unlike, let's say, somebody who makes political jokes, and Mark Thomas is actually drilled down into the hard rock of the political details.
Yeah.
So he's politically fluent. He knows of what he speaks. So he's talking about maybe they're doing a show over there, talking about I was talking to his one of his posse, a woman named Sal, which is an interesting woman name for a woman, Sal. So Sal, the woman, was we were talking about anyway. She and I were talking about the role of hedge funds in the global economy. For example, we were talking about a company like Coca-Cola. People who protest against Coca-Cola, they're going down the traditional routes of identifying where Coke is committing crime or human rights abuses or ecological devastation and then trying to get the media to look at it and trying to get politicians to look at it to change the law and change people's perceptions a little bit and try and get that into the media so that there's an outcry for some change.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question came up, the obvious question is, okay, who's the biggest shareholder of Coca-Cola? And there was a big silence. Because there's a remarkable vacuum on in terms of the role now, which has evolved over the past 30 years, that hedge funds play in shaping our global economy, our global media, and society. Now, the biggest shareholder of Coca-Cola is Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett went into Israel with a $4 billion investment into a metals company. Right thereafter, Israel invaded Lebanon and destroyed several factories, a glass factory, a dairy factory, a wood factory. So now Lebanon won't be competing with Israel in any near future, will they?
No. No, it doesn't seem that way.
Warren Buffett, second richest man in the world, biggest shareholder of Coke in the world, with the United States cooperation, enters Israel with a huge multi-billion dollar investment. There's a big story out this week about how Warren thinks Israel is a great place to invest. And shortly thereafter, they destroy his competition. So now what's that all about? That's about money moving and hedge funds moving. And it's about the finance of destruction, the finance of globalization, the finance of societal degradation and ecological degradation, which has its source at the banks and the hedge funds. So unless you're talking about hedge funds and you're talking about banks, you're not talking really you're going to a gunfight with a knife. I always make this comparison. You are under, you're aiming low, I would say. If your target is to talk to the company and talk to politics and to talk to the media, you're aiming low because none of those people have the power. None of those people are pulling the strings. Unless you're talking to the banks and the hedge funds, then, you know, you're just, in effect, giving these companies cover in which to hide because they can say that they engage the activists and we're concerned, which is false because they know that you haven't really engaged them at all because you haven't engaged the banking portion of this phenomenon. So now what happens also is that we've talked to many people in the UK, the BBC, Channel 5, Channel 4, many people, many media people about the Karma Bank technique for decapitalizing rogue companies like a Coca-Cola. $100 billion societal nightmare. Destroys societies, destroys the economy, destroys the ecology. They do so via corporate subsidies. In other words, corporate welfare. If it wasn't for America dishing out the socialism to Coca-Cola, all those free billions, Coca-Cola would be a backwater in Atlanta serving pop out of a truck, as it, you know, was 100 years ago or so. So we talk about the banking situation. So what happens is that you've got media groups in the UK in particular who, I mean, at least they've looked at it. In America, they don't even look at it.
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
So that, I mean, that's kudos to the UK for looking at it. In America, they are scared to death of the corporation. They will not even pretend to, they're so scared of corporations, they become religious right-wing fundamental evangelical fanatics. They're so scared of corporations, they're willing to kill themselves now. They're actually got these Jesus camps set up for kids, et cetera, because they're so afraid of the corporations and upsetting the corporations. But at least in the UK, they're willing to look at it. So over there in the UK, they are interested, of course, in taking on the corporations because this is the source of society's ills. The corporations are profiting. They're war profiteers. BAE is a UK government. It's a war profiteer. Halliburton is a war profiteer. Kellogg Brown and Root, a subsidiary of Halliburton, is teaching soldiers. I should say the soldiers are teaching the Kellogg, Root and Brown consultants how to do their jobs. So the Halliburton employees get paid hugely in Iraq. The soldiers get nothing. There's a wealth transference going on. Send the soldiers out on patrol, get blown up. We don't have to pay him his salary anymore. He already taught the Kellogg, Root and Brown guy back in the shed how to do the electronics job. War profiteering. So we already know there's war profiteering is going on in the military, and obviously these military contractors have huge sway politically. But there's war profiteering and eco-degradation profiteering going on in the S&P 500, the FTSE 100, the corporate sector. Coca-Cola, first and foremost, is a war profiteer, a war against the ecology, the war against society, and they're profiting handsomely. But people know this. They feel they know this. They have a feeling this is going on, so they want to do something. So they want to expose the company. And, of course, these media companies are owned by these huge conglomerates. At the top of the media conglomerate sits board members who also sit on the board of banks who are also the clients of Coca-Cola, et cetera, et cetera. It's hugely incestuous. The higher you go, the more incest you find in the banking corporate sector. So what happens is you get to these big media companies, and they are interested in these corporate exposés because they know it, people are frightened out there and it drives ratings. But the second you start talking about the banking sector, they clam up. They're like, oh, that's a little bit too it's too complicated. The audience won't understand that. As if the audience doesn't understand when their hands in their pocket and they're getting their money stolen. You know, as if the audience doesn't understand that there's a burglar in their house and they're stealing all their wealth. I would say that people understand when they're getting their future stolen from them. People understand when they get their money stolen from them. People understand when they get their ecological resources stolen from them. People understand that Coke is stealing from them. They understand that. How do you do that unless you're at the bank? So anyway, you know, the thing is the corporate level, the big corporate conglomerates, because they're so tied into these banks for their loans, for their expansion projects, for their transformation of the FCC and the transformation of the media laws to get ever and ever greater concentrations of media control. Once you start talking about the banks, then suddenly, oh, the audience is too stupid to understand banking. or we can't possibly go down that path because it's not going to fulfill our charter to be completely conversant in all 360 degrees of the issue as it's related to us through the charter that was written by the media lords back in, you know, blah, 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 blah. And as a result, Coca-Cola has a get-out-of-jail-free card. They are unchallenged in the ways that will actually expose the inner workings of their war profiteering and mass genocide. Is that a polarizing statement I just made? Yeah. Are your kids now probably going to get cancer this generation? Yeah. So, okay, let's all be nice and nice and play nice with each other, but kiss your kids goodbye. I mean, is that too radical? I'm sorry. Your kids are just cannon fodder for the war profiteers. I didn't know you had no empathy for your own children. I forgot. I'm sorry. That's fine. So anyway, here we are on the front page of the Financial Times. This is the front page of the Financial Times. Okay, put down Entertainment Weekly for a second. Let's look at the Financial Times. Front page. Hedge funds to use high-tech filter to harvest market gossip. Okay, there's a new product coming out in Germany. It's called Monitor 110. It monitors hundreds of thousands of blogs every single day for market gossip. There are 175,000 new blogs created every day. This product will comb through hundreds of thousands of blogs to pick up on market chatter and market gossip. Why? Because hedge funds are driven not by any fundamental truth, not by any fundamental value, but by perception and by playing the players. They know that gossip and rumors can be capitalized just as easily as hardcore sales, which are tied to hardcore economics of supply and demand and scarcity value. Gossip is something that has an infinite supply. The hedge fund community is now tying into this thing, which I call virtual economics, which is the fact that things like gossip can be generated with infinite quantities. And now there's a new filtering tool to filter gossip in ways that will give hedge funds a trading edge, so that they can go into the market, see what their gossip is, and then make their trades accordingly. Are they actually looking at the balance sheet of the corporation? No. Are they looking at the income statement of the corporation? No. Are they looking at the management of the corporation? No. Are they looking at the perception of the corporation amongst hundreds of thousands and millions of blogs around the world for the next 3 days based on some rumor? Yes. That's what's driving economics. Unless you're willing to accept that, you're barking up the wrong tree. The way to fight a Coca-Cola is to get in there, get in the trenches, and talk to this blogosphere and communicate to them that for every dollar they do not spend on Coca-Cola's product, it affects the company's balance sheet by close to $5. And you can engineer a wealth transference scheme from Coke shareholders to the most disadvantaged among us simply by making a negative bet against Coke, entering the blogosphere, communicating to those people around the world, Coke's in 200 different countries, and as the stock price declines, your bet, it makes some money, and you distribute the proceeds accordingly. Now, that would be a way to decapitalize Coca-Cola using the blogosphere, talking directly to the public, and affect a positive social change. Of course, it would mean being proactive. And my point is that I just don't feel, at the end of the day, that people who are reliant on major media for distribution are, in their heart of hearts, willing to be proactive in a way that's going to make this economic balancing point between monopolization of the banking system and the distribution of wealth as it should be engineered through proactivity, through a proactive approach. There are hundreds of millions of people out there who have the ability to boycott Coca-Cola based on the information that can be conveyed to them by a major media company, but that major media company will never convey to the people the information they need to make this choice because they themselves are reliant on the social welfare, the corporate welfare that is given to them. So there's a huge disconnect there. That's why the social change is going to happen from the grassroots up. It'll happen. The dawn of this phenomenon will happen from the grassroots up. It'll happen. Mm. It's going to happen. We're going to make it happen. We've got what's that? What's going on over there?
But the interesting thing about this market gossip goes high tech is that the whole activist community, everything is about, their one little fact that they rally around. even with Coca-Cola, for example, there's a bunch of people who are boycotting it because of stealing groundwater in India. And then you've got the people who are boycotting it because of Colombia. And everything is about their one little fact. And even when you were talking about how you could unite everybody and forget all the facts, forget wasting all your time and money researching these facts and proving it and talking to the CEO about these facts on the ground, the hedge funds are saying, like, we're forgetting facts too. We're going for gossip. Forget it.
This is the amazing thing.
Yeah, so why waste all your time confabs?
Yeah, you can factually prove that Coke is killing people.
Mm-hmm.
So what? Does that mean the government's going to change the law? No. Does that mean they're going to stop marketing? No. Does that mean they're going to stop selling the product? Facts are meaningless in this economy that are driven purely by rumor. Now, this goes back to the whole discussion about virtual markets and the Hollywood Stock Exchange and whether they're predictive or not. And, you know, I'll throw something else out there. My understanding is that this type of database that tracks rumors gave the producers of that movie Crash last year the ability to – they have the only producers in Hollywood with access to the database on the Hollywood Stock Exchange. They were able to target Academy voters and to guarantee a win for Best Picture for the movie Crash last year due to their access to the Hollywood Stock Exchange database that's mm-hmm. exclusive to them.
How's that?
How is that?
Yeah.
Because there's a conflict of interest between those two corporations, the owners, the current owners, and the producers of that movie Crash.
Well, but that's the beauty of this hedge fund betting on based on market gossip is everybody, for some reason, assumes that it's not legitimate data. You know, they think it's just a game. Oh, well, you know, these hedge funds are just playing with a game of gossip when that is the market.
That's
right. Feeling and emotion is mostly makes up about 90% of the market.
That's right. That's right. These markets, these virtual markets, are reality. This is another conversation we've had repeatedly. Who was the editor over at the Times? The Times.
The Sunday Times. Yeah.
What was her name?
I forget. It was so long ago. But
yeah, she was. She called up and she wanted to talk about the virtual markets, and she was just talking about that. Oh well, you mean it's a game? And I'm like, well, it's a game, just like the New York Stock Exchange is a game.
Yeah, she asked you about your Coca-Cola hedge fund and boycott idea, and you mentioned it's a virtual market. And she said, a what? And you said, a virtual market. It's a virtual currency. And she said, a virtual currency? What's that?
Yeah, and this is the business editor of the Times of London, yeah. Who had absolutely no, had never heard of the fact that the entire market is now driven with what's called algorithmic trading, which is based on things like filtering rumors.
Mm-hmm.
How is this possible? It's because since the 1970s, when the U.S. went off the gold standard, the markets have been transformed because there's a flood of currencies that have no intrinsic value. The U.S. dollar is not a piece of equity. It's a piece of debt. There's no intrinsic value to the U.S. dollar. There's almost no intrinsic value to a British pound. The values are driven by waves of rumors coming and going. And hedge funds will act on rumors coming and going. This changes prices, and then this changes people's reality. Reality is the tail end of the situation. Reality is created on the hedge fund community, and they're trading rumors, and as a result of their rumor trading, you end up with the outcome, which is reality. It doesn't mean you can predict reality. It doesn't mean you can predict outcomes either. I mean, that's a false conclusion. It just means that reality is being driven by rumor trading because the hedge funds have over $1.2 trillion in cash to work with globally. But they control close to $100 trillion in trading and in trades at the end of the year. There's $400 trillion in derivative products. These are not hard dollar values. These are just notional electronic values that are swapped from bank to bank to bank based on rumors. This is rumor arbitrage. This is all rumors. So this is what I've been talking to Greenpeace about. Remember, we went to Greenpeace three times and we said, look, you keep pointing out that these companies are doing bad, and here's the evidence. But we already know what the evidence is. We already know what the problems are. If you're trying to get this company to change based on pointing out the fact that they're criminals, forget it, because you're aiming too low. The company itself relies on this global hedge fund community, and the hedge fund community relies on rumors. And unless you're willing to go into that mosh pit and talk to the global community about these facts and say, look, if you want to take down a company like Coke, if you want to change a company like Coke, if you want to transfer your sovereignty away from a corporation back to you, the citizen, and you want to take Coke out of the picture. And I think that's a worthy cause. Coke has demonstrated itself to be a corporate disease. If you want to remove it from the picture, you've got to then incentivize the global hedge fund community to start making negative bets against that stock by shorting the company, by buying puts, by trading against that stock. Attack Coke stock. Why would they do that? Because you're organizing a global boycott where now instead of making $20 billion a year in revenue, they're going to make only $15 billion a year in revenue next year. The stock's trading at something like, 20 times earnings. Well, if the revenues are dropping by 10, 20, 30%, then that earnings multiple is going to drop by 10, 20%. That means the stock goes from $45 to $35, $30, $22 a share. That's a $50 billion dislocation in capital. If you're set up to capture that, you can make almost an unlimited amount of money with almost zero risk, which you can then give to these disadvantaged people in India. Now, if you're not willing to do that, what the hell are you willing to do? You want to point out to the fact that, the Coke's a bad company. They're involved in shady dealings. They're killing people. We already know that. Everybody knows that. And the fact that maybe not everyone knows it, but they watch a show and they say now instead of 500,000 people in the world knowing it or 5 million people in the world knowing it, let's say now 6 or 7 or 10 million people now in the world know that Coca-Cola is engaged in genocide. So what? Have you been talking about the banking system, the hedge fund community, and how, in fact, these two are related and how by altering the risk-reward ratio of trading Coke is the only way you're going to change the risk-reward ratio of Coke as the corporate entity? You've got to change Coke's risk-reward ratio for operating their business. So you have to talk about a term like risk and reward, banking, hedge funds. And then if you say, well, the audience is too stupid, they don't know this stuff. Well, okay, then get an ice cream cart and go down to the shore, Blackpool, and sell ice cream. You know, retire.
I hate that phrase of like the audience is too stupid. We hear that constantly about trying to speak about finance or business. You say, we're constantly here that, you know, the audience won't understand. The audience will be turned off. And we don't find that to be true at all. Like if you speak higher than the audience, you want them to strive to know and understand more about their reality around them.
Yeah, the higher up you go in the media control distribution, the closer you get to hearing that the audience is too stupid to know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's Frank Quattroni, who's a market manipulator on Wall Street. He basically is walking free today because the judge said that the jury is too stupid to understand the complexity of his financial crimes. They never really tried to educate the jury. They just assumed it was true.
Exactly.
So now he's out in the street committing more financial crimes.
But it's like that Harriet Tubman thing, too, because, you know, he and his defense team walk in there and they say to the jury, you're too stupid to know this. So they take that in. They internalize that and say, I'm too stupid to know that. So the same thing with the economy, markets, finance. Activists tell themselves, we're too stupid to know that. That's too esoteric. That's too, you know, it's something we don't understand. You have to be a trained economist.
Plus, it's not sexy. You know, activists like to put on the little rubber suits, get in their rubber boats, and go, you know, and throw rocks at a big oil tanker.
Mm-hmm.
And then they, you know, sit around the campfire at night making googly eyes at each other, getting
yeah.
their little stipend of 300 euros a month. That's a lot of fun, summer camp for activism, but it's not going to, it's meaningless. I mean, it was important 70 years ago, but today it's meaningless. And I just think that the change is going to come from the bottom up, because what's happening is that right now you've got an explosion in altruism happening on YouTube. You know, reading about YouTube again today in the Financial Times, and they're talking about YouTube is completely metamorphosizing politics in America and politics around the world because it's totally out of control. You can't control it. YouTube is anarchy, and anarchy beats monopolization and fascism. America's become fascist. The UK has become American, therefore fascist by proxy. The only way you can fight it is with anarchy, and YouTube is anarchy. There's no way. There's no central control on YouTube. Something can be released on YouTube at any second, and it could be seen by 10 million people instantly for no reason other than it's just the way it is. It's the unpredictability of creation. And then now it's merging with politics. You know, we've said on this show for 3 years that the thing about the internet revolution is that there's no political edge. And then Howard Dean's campaign came, and it showed the potential. Then Ned Lamont's campaign came through, and it realized that potential, that you could get an internet-based candidate winning a major office, a major nomination now to run. Hopefully he'll beat Lieberman. Lieberman is a fascist supporter. And now we're seeing this on the national and international stage. In France, of course, because of the bloggers, the European Union Constitution was defeated last year. Mm-hmm. Due to les blogueurs. Blogging is the highest penetration of bloggers in the world is right here in France. This is the blogging. This is why we live in France. This is the blogging capital of the world. This is where the next revolution is going to take place. It's Bastille Part 2. It's going to happen on the web. Blogging will totally influence this market, and it's completely free. There's zero gravity. Electrons are free. There's no friction at all in this economy. It's a frictionless virtual economy where values start from nothing and end up with something, and it's the inverse of everything we've had to live with for 200 years, where you start with something and end up with nothing. America started somewhere, now it's nowhere. The internet started nowhere, now it's somewhere. Because it's a complete reversal of everything we've been taught for the last 200 years since Adam Smith's Wealth of the Nation, the invisible hand, supply and demand, Thomas Malthus, scarcity values, the dismal science. It's all crap now due to the fact that electrons are free, and they're going to have to combat the fact that elections are rigged. Rigged elections meet free electrons. Radicalism in the electronic world will defeat monopolists and fascists in America and Britain. And, you know, we're willing to do it right now in ways that need to be done to get the job done, to end tyranny and oppression in America by the corporate occupation. And it's happening right now, and no one's fired a shot. I mean, I know the other guys like to kill people wantonly to make a few quick bucks. In my opinion, Warren Buffett is a war profiteer. Warren Buffett has committed human rights violations. Warren Buffett is a war criminal. It's no coincidence that, he makes a $4 billion investment in Israel next week. Oh, well, let's go bomb Lebanon and take out all their industrial capabilities. Oh, no more competition for Warren, the biggest shareholder in Exxon. I mean, in Coca-Cola. So, you know, I think that the forces of the global insurrection are gaining speed, and they're putting the bums out of office. And it's gathering apace. And the old media really have no idea what's going on. The activist community is still going down the same worn path of expose and outrage and then hope for political expediency, which is a great way to, if you have insomnia and you need to think about something that'll put you to sleep, start thinking about activism in the past 30 years.
Exactly.
Let's watch paint dry. Let's watch grass grow. Let's watch reruns of Jeremy Paxman over the last 20 years, arching his eyebrows. So speaking of Exxon, you know, on this show, I guess it was last year or 18 months ago, we said that, who did we say? We said that people I think we were talking about those fund managers, the Free Enterprise Action Fund. Mm-hmm. We said that they were appeasers. They were climate holocaust appeasers, and that they were flooding the airways with propaganda and lies.
Yep. And now?
Yep. Now it turns out that the managers of the Free Enterprise Action Fund are corporate holocaust appeasers and filling the airways with propaganda and lies.
What, they've been found out?
More or less. Climate change storm hits Exxon.
See? Because now comes the proof. We had the gossip before. We knew. We had the hedge fund-like instinct for rumor.
That's right.
And we knew it to be, it was affecting the markets.
That's right.
And now all these activists have waited like 18 months, and they finally gather the evidence. But we already knew that because that was the rumor.
That's right. We knew this 18 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the fact that activists have been harping on getting all the data and evidence and documents to support it means that they lost 18 months.
Exactly.
Now, is that when I talked to the head of Greenpeace about this, mm-hmm. remember, I talked to Gerard Leopold, who runs Greenpeace International. And I said, we're able to suss out these things quicker because we're looking at the markets. And he said he would never change his way of doing campaigning based on markets because he could never get his supporters to be passionate about something like that. And I said, yeah, but Gerd, your methods have not been effective, really. And it looks like this climate change problem is really accelerating. We don't really have a lot of time left. And he looked at me straight in the face and said, Gerd Leopold, head of Greenpeace, when I said climate change is a problem and that we need to try something new, he said to me, and I quote, "We have all the time in the world."
Mm-hmm. Well, but the difference is, you know what? I just realized that a good analogy for this is those people in Sri Lanka when the tsunami hit. Now, some of them were lucky enough to have been on a tourist attraction of riding an elephant. And the elephants took off and ran into the woods.
Right.
The other tourists were on the beach and walked out as the water was going out, retreating.
That's right.
And they're like, wow, what is this?
Look at all those pretty shells. I'm going to grab them because I'm greedy.
They needed the evidence that something bad was about to happen. But unfortunately, with a tsunami like that, it's over. The evidence comes all too violently. But luckily, the people who were on the elephant, who were acting by instinct, the elephant didn't need to see the wave to know something was coming.
That's right.
It ran away.
That's right.
Well, this is exactly what we're talking about is, you know, you need to act quicker. You need to trust your instincts. And our instinct was that the rumors were true.
Well, yeah, because we saw price changes in the markets.
Exactly.
And because the hedge fund community is the global nervous system.
Yeah.
That is the hedge fund community is the global nervous system. Mm-hmm. If you're unwilling to plug into that global nervous system, then you'll never know what's going on, and you'll always be many, many steps behind the curve. I mean, basically, this story in the Financial Times that the hedge fund community is developing a product that plugs them into hundreds of thousands of blogs and they can filter gossip means that their sophistication in determining the global nervous system is ratcheting up. But in the activist side, there's no concurrent progress toward getting this type of intelligence, this type of awareness. So they're always now, instead of being 18 months behind or 24 months behind or 5 years behind, they're going to be 10 years behind. And pretty soon it's pointless. It's pointless if you're basically chopping off your limbs and saying and using your chopped off limb as evidence that you've chopped off your limb. And that's your protest against a company like Exxon? Self-annihilation? Self-immolation? Immolation? Immolation motion? Emulsion? What does it mean when you torture yourself?
Self-immolation.
Immolation. Self-immolation. Yeah, so it's, if you're not plugging into this, what is it? Climate change storm hits Exxon. So ExxonMobil is spreading inaccurate and misleading information about climate change and funding groups that misinform the public on the issue. The most prestigious British scientist group alleges. Well, I mean, yeah, of course they are doing it. When Free Enterprise Action Fund, when they wrote about us, we saw the emails internally going back and forth to Exxon Corporation before they made any statement at all.
Mm-hmm.
There's collusion. There was contact between Junk Science, which is a division of Fox News, and Exxon. Not only that, but we saw the emails between Exxon, Junk Science, and the Wall Street Journal.
Mm-hmm.
We had two callers from the Wall Street Journal who are also plugged into the nervous system of deceit, who are being tipped by Free Enterprise Action Fund and Junk Science and Malloy and Borelli, who are also connected to Exxon directly, and the lawyers in D.C., and then the FLACs, the CEI, whatever it's called.
Mm-hmm. CEI.
These FLACs are all plugged into that nervous system of deceit.
Well, you know the interesting thing, actually, the story we've been talking about, the hedge fund market gossip machine, the technology, that's bought and financed by Deutsche Bank.
Yeah.
Who was part of that whole Free Enterprise Action Fund little tiff across the Atlantic.
That's right.
Remember, they basically called Deutsche Bank Nazis.
That's right. So you had Americans calling Deutsche Bank Nazis, and Borelli and Malloy called the Deutsche Bank. They were saying, you would think that the Deutsche Bank would be sensitive toward burning people alive, making some kind of Nazi reference.
Yeah, but the fact is, you could charge the Free Enterprise Action Fund with very much being just like the Greenpeace activists. They're dealing with a corporation. They're taking commands from a corporation.
Yeah.
When Exxon is run by the Deutsche Banks of the world.
Correct. I see. Yes, you're absolutely correct.
So they don't talk to banks. In fact, they're suing Goldman Sachs for for having any climate change initiatives. So they have no understanding at all of what.
Yeah, they're complete morons.
That's probably why they dropped off the face of the earth once they launched a lawsuit against Goldman Sachs.
Never heard from them again.
Never.
Oh, my God. Well, Speaking about greenhouse gas emissions, California sues automakers. You were talking about this yesterday.
Yep, they launched a lawsuit against the six of the world's largest automakers over global warming on Wednesday, charging that greenhouse gases from their vehicles have caused billions of dollars in damages.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first of its kind to seek to hold manufacturers liable for damages caused by their vehicles' emissions. And it comes less than a month after California lawmakers adopted the nation's first global warming law mandating a cut in greenhouse gas emissions.
Right.
Apparently, part of the reason why they're suing them is because automakers have so far blocked those rules that that California passed, forcing that where they said that car makers have to cut their tailpipe emissions by something like 25%.
Mm-hmm.
So automakers have so far blocked those rules with their own legal action,
mm-hmm.
prompting California to countersue and actually then bring in the first of this kind, because now it's in the public domain and now it's going to be tried in a court of law that these cars are causing greenhouse gas emissions.
That's right. It's a good intention, but look at what's happening on the big picture here. Is Bush is setting up a parallel Supreme Court.
Mm.
He's also criminalizing dissent and free speech.
Yeah.
And also the protesters from the Earth Liberation Front who were very actively protesting against the extinction of humans through corporate misbehavior just got very severe sentence, prison terms, and fines applied to them. So I think that this is a stalling tactic. It's good that they're taking this to the courts, but this is going to take a long time. Meanwhile, the parts per million of carbon dioxide emissions in the atmosphere are climbing past that 400 per million number, which is the inertia no-go back level. Once you go over 400, then you can't go back. Once you're a pickle, never a cucumber. There will be no turning back at that point. Looks like we're going to trip over that 400 number in the next 18 to 24 months. What was the story yesterday? That huge Arctic ice chunk block melting, cracking.
Yep. There's a crack on the European part of the Arctic. So it goes from Norway all the way up to the Arctic Pole.
Right.
A crack in the perennial ice, which, of course, once you have those cracks, then water gets in there and starts to melt it back.
Right.
Within 10, 20 years, you could possibly be able to just drive some ships through there.
That's right.
Right over the Arctic.
And explore for more oil.
Yep, that's what they are. They're already starting those lawsuits. Canada says they own it. America says, no, we want some of that because we're an empire.
Mm-hmm.
So we own everything in the world unless we allow you to have a share of it.
Yeah, Canada's mad because the U.S. sent one of their citizens to a death camp, to a death oven in Syria, to a torture center in Syria, spuriously, because somebody was having a bad hair day at the airport in New York. Poor guy, sent to Syria, got tortured to within an inch of his life.
He's lucky he wasn't with his baby because they had his six-month-old baby.
Yeah.
Apparently he was a terrorist, a six-month-old baby.
He's classified as a terrorist, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he needs to be waterboarded. He might know where Osama is. Cuckoo, kakak, Osama. Oh my God, he just said Osama. Quick, torture him. He knows where Osama is. So these huge cracks are opening up in the ice, which exposes the black water, which of course does not reflect sunlight. It absorbs sunlight. So this heats up the area even more, creates water. Of course, the ice is flowing on ice, and as the ice melts, it creates a lubricant underneath these sheets of ice, so they're sliding faster away from the center. The summer, usually at this time in these areas where you're kicking over to winter, there's a refreezing of the ice. Scientists are saying this is the first year on recorded history now that you're not seeing that the ice is not refreezing like it has been for thousands of years. The ice is just continuing to melt. So you have 12 month per year ice melt going on. You have a big, fat, American, stupid tourist up there watching Earth melt in real time as a tourist attraction, paying $20 a head to watch the world collapse with their finger up their nose, and they got some vibrator up their ass and a Twinkie down their throat saying, oh, my God, the Earth's collapsing, Marge. Pass me another Coca-Cola. So, yeah, you can go to the courts, and you can fight this in the courts, of course. But and number one, the whole court system is being overwritten by the Bush administration that's going pre-Magna Carta, pre-habeas corpus, any kind of civilizing rights that separated this community from the feudal lords of the pre-1215 Middle Ages, Dark Ages. So it's going to take time. I say that the only bright spot in the world for pushback against the monopolists and the monarchs is YouTube, Linux, free software, P2P file swapping. Now, the deals that YouTube has cut with Warner Music to have some ads alongside all the copyrighted material, it's a good deal. There's going to be a recycling of all this copyrighted material that's been locked in corporate balance sheets. It's going to be recycled in the public domain. And, okay, there's going to be some click ads on the side. It's fine. No problem. Little ads on the side for a little click, click, click. You get all this material back into the public domain. The fact is, though, the copyrighted material, the price for copyrighted material, is going to continue to fall. It doesn't have to fall all the way to zero, but it can fall toward zero. It's the asymptotic curve of copyrighted material value falling toward zero. It doesn't mean it goes to zero. It just means it's always going toward zero. Instead of charging $15 for a DVD or $15 for a download of a movie, that price goes to $10 to $5 to $4 to $2 to $1, 50 cents, 25 cents, 5 cents, a penny, 0.002 of a penny. Doesn't matter, because electrons are free. If you've got 10,000 movies in your back catalog and you can still get a nickel per download, all you have to do is fire all your executives and you're still cash flow positive.
Exactly.
I mean, that's what's going to happen to these huge copyright aggregators in Hollywood, you know, companies with huge back catalogs of copyrighted material. They'll sell the catalog to YouTube. YouTube will get value out of it, but you've got to fire all the executives. You can't pay executives $1 million a year to do what? To go make movies that are being made for free, by people on the web? Why would you pay someone to do something you can get for free? That makes no sense. Oh, unless you're in the service of the agencies, the talent agencies in Los Angeles, the creative artists, William Morris, who have tried to monopolize the media distribution pricing, so you end up paying Brad Pitt $20 million? For what? So that he can keep your eyeballs amused for 2 hours? I can go on YouTube and be amused for 2 hours just as easily as anything Brad Pitt's ever been in, except for maybe Fight Club. You know? So the whole economics changing. There's an economic revolution happening right now. It's modern economics 2.0. It's based on free, altruism, network, social networks, and everyone's scrambling now. Politically, this is the key, though. Politically, that what has to happen is that politically we have to have a Ned Lamont-size national, global political referendum.
Well, that's the thing, is that's always the weak point of any of these, because, well, the U.S. government, they always assassinate the physical human being who is a leader. So, you know, that's what happened in the last time America had some sort of resurgent civil society, was they assassinated Martin Luther King Jr. They assassinated Malcolm X. They assassinated JFK, Robert Kennedy. Everybody was assassinated.
Yeah, Malcolm X.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the thing is that you're going back to those days, you had what's called in economics term and technology terms a single point of failure.
Yeah, yeah.
And so in other words, Martin Luther King was a gifted once-in-a-lifetime leader.
Yeah, and then when he was killed, then it all disappeared, that whole black civil rights movement.
Pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, took a while to peter out, but that was the beginning of it, really.
Yeah, he totally raised it to a level that was completely unexpected, and when he was gone, it fell unexpectedly.
Mm-hmm.
No one's been able to take his place. Jesse Jackson has certainly not filled the shoes. Andrew Young, who was marching with Martin Luther King down there in Alabama, was just on the board of Walmart. Was
exactly.
Advising the Walmart board how to more effectively create ghettofying Walmart stores in the ghetto to destroy the black community. So he got totally sold out. You know, Walmart continuing to appear in the news is trying to. We talked about Tesco yesterday, and we can talk about Walmart again soon, I'm sure, because I didn't see anything on Walmart today in the newspaper, although it seems like at least two or three times a week there's a huge Walmart story. But these leaders, once they're taken out, so it's a single point of failure. So when you take out a Martin Luther King Jr., you take out a whole movement. Now, what's different now is the network. The network doesn't have a single point of failure. This is the point of the internet, is that you can take out a big piece of it and it still works because there's infinite paths that the packets of information can travel. So politically, in the political expediency movement And the global insurrection against corporate occupation has adopted the internet as their primary means of distributing information, news, and dissent. So if you take out any one of the major nodes, you have not done anything, really, to destroy the internet. Now, this is also very, very interesting because it exposes a huge fallacy in the Bush administration's war on terror, because their whole strategy has been to take out Osama bin Laden, who is the quote-unquote mastermind of the Al-Qaeda network.
Yeah.
Which is completely ridiculous because it's not a hierarchical structure. It's a network.
He's already out there. He's a meme. He's an idea.
Well, it's impossible to they've just taken the complete wrong approach. Not only do they have the wrong approach of trying to knock out the leader, which is impossible when you're talking about a network situation, but they're also trying to in this so-called war on terror is that they are rolling back their own civil rights, and the thing that would fight terrorism, as it's, that word is understood in America, would be to enhance civil rights in America. Look, rewrite the Constitution to give more rights to people. Now, how much have they spent, for example, in Iraq? $300 billion, maybe?
Yeah, it's hard to say because they hide so much of it.
So let's say it's $300 billion. You know, how much graft and corruption and all these companies are involved, or profiteering and stock market value?
About $150 billion, I would say, went straight into the pockets of the likes of Halliburton, Bechtel, Dick Cheney.
Okay, now, here's how you completely stop the war on terror. And the solution is so easy, and you have to ask yourself, well, if it's so easy, why don't they do it? And the answer is that they're making huge money not doing it. The war on terror is the war against the difficulty in making money. The war on terror is the easiest way these guys have ever made money in their careers. Dick Cheney has never made an easier buck than he has as war profiteering now. Now, if you want to get rid of what you the terrorism as it's perceived, this word in America, here's what you do. You take your $150 billion that you're going to flush down the toilet, and you contract with Dell Computer or with Nokia Telephones, or maybe that Chinese laptop company that just bought Chinese laptops, the ThinkPad.
Lenovo.
Or you call the MIT lab and you talk about this new project they got going, the $150 laptop computer. You put an order in for 100 million laptops, okay, at those prices, or 50 million laptops. You talk to the telephone companies and the satellite network companies. You, instead of America being the 16th highest, 16th on the league table for broadband penetration, you make sure America's number one for broadband penetration. And you encourage broadband penetration around the world. You tell Hollywood, look, we've got a serious situation on you. You're going to have to put your monopoly, milking your monopoly profits on hold for a few years because we have a situation here. We have to step into the situation and create something here. You put those, you distribute those 50 million or 100 million laptops around the world, and you allow people around the world to totally bypass their local scene, their local politics, to hook directly into a global conversation, which is happening now on YouTube anyway, which is happening in free Linux software anyway, free software anyway. You empower people all over the world by giving them access via cheap laptop to the free dial tone, essentially, to enter the global conversation. So that people who, and the problem is people are cut off and they are victimized by the local propaganda that radicalizes people. If you want to de-radicalize people, plug them into the global conversation. How do you do that? Right, it's easy now with laptops, cell phones, satellite communications, broadband penetration. The cost of this is compared to the flushing the toilet down the money down the toilet in Iraq versus the money that's being flushed down the toilet everywhere else in America. Is trying to quote unquote install democracy, but they're really just trying to monopolize local economy. It's cheap, and that's how effectively you would destroy radical fundamentalist terrorism, whatever you want to call it in the world today. That's how you would do it. It's so obvious. It's almost absurd. It's absurdly obvious. But you're not going to have that because, of course, that would mean that the monopoly value being milked out of Hollywood for having bad broadband and reliance on people to have to go to Walmart every Tuesday to buy a DVD for $15-16 because they can't get broadband on their home computer. So Hollywood would be against it. People in America are not thinking globally. They're not thinking conscientiously. They're not thinking about their own survival at this point. America is just impaling itself on its own dysfunction. They're willfully impaling itself themselves on their own short-sightedness. It's like you show me a sword sticking out of the ground, and America can't impale itself on it quick enough. They have no sense of self-preservation at all. And that's what's scary about the country right now. And when you watch these news reports coming out of Fox News and CNN, you're watching somebody justifying hanging themselves. And that's scary. It's always scary to see that. It's always scary. It's like watching the Blair Witch Project. They're going into the woods. You know that they're going to meet up with the forces of their destruction. And you know that they're going to get lost in the woods. And you know at the end they're going to be pleading desperately for someone to come and save them. But they've alienated people around the world so horribly that nobody wants to come and save them. And this is what every time I look at Fox News or I watch Bill O'Reilly or I hear Rush Limbaugh, this replay of the Blair Witch Project. And you even have Tony Blair. Tony Blair is part of it. It's a Tony Blair Witch Project. Just replays that movie over and over as this country as a whole walks into the darkness of that woods, gets totally lost and meets its own destruction based on its own egocentric and ill preparedness to deal with the global community as a whole. It's frightening to look at. But then again, from this perspective, being thousands of miles away, it is my only source of entertainment right now that I find amusing. It is amusing to me, I must say. I did like the Blair Witch Project, and I am somewhat amused by watching America throw itself into the gutter. You wouldn't imagine that a $13 trillion economy would be doing this, but you know, the bigger they are, the bigger they fall. It's like the guy with the beans. He's up there with the bean.
Jack and the Beanstalk.
Jack and the Beanstalk.
Yeah.
Well. Yeah. I'm sure that everyone will get jobs and retire and have a nice life. I'm sure it's all just an illusion, really. Don't worry about it.
It's only a movie.
Don't worry. You'll be saved at the last second. John Wayne will come. Ronald Reagan's going to come and save you in the last second. Don't worry. You're all going to be safe. Well. Okay, so I think that's about all the podcast. We got a new feature now. We take a 3 or 4 minute clip from the podcast and we have it as a 3 or 4 minute clip with a little video, and we can get that on YouTube.
Exactly. I think people may have noticed. In fact, Biffin Bridge, the mayor of Biffin Bridge, plucked us. He put us on his site, our thing about the private banking Pope.
Yeah, I think this is going to be good.
Yeah.
You know, because the thing about the podcasting market is that not everybody has an hour to listen to a podcast.
No.
So your market is limited by that very limiting factor. But a 3 minute clip, espresso clip with some visuals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we're cutting through podcasting to new podcasting terrain here.
Mm-hmm.
We're raising the bar to podcasters out there. By the way, there's a good article in the Herald Tribune today about new devices for podcasters.
Oh, good.
Like the Eaterall that we use?
Yeah, yeah.
There's a couple of others on the market that they're talking about them.
Oh, good.
And this woman whose name is her name is Sal.
Mm-hmm.
She says she's getting into the podcasting racket.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She said, "Oh, it's very expensive to get into the podcasting racket." I was like, okay, Sal, that's another thing you're dead wrong about.
Uh-huh.
Aren't I nice guy?
Yeah, well, it is, I guess, if you're not planning on doing it every day for a whole year or two, you know, if you're not planning on doing this for real.
No, but seriously, if you get a mic and stick it into your computer, then the mic costs £20.
Yeah,
not
exactly.
Even £10.
£10, yeah.
You can be podcasting for £10.
Exactly.
Now, that's the truth.
Yeah.
If you want to get an Eaterall, like we have, how much did that cost? $340?
About $500.
Oh, maybe it is expensive. I'll tell you what, if we do this show with those people over there, I'll give Sal one of these units as a gift. I'm not above bribing people.
Okay.